Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of meaning is invested in a memorial to a fallen soldier? By the grieving parent who commissions it, by the sculptor convinced it could be his magnum opus, and by others affected by the tragic end of a very short life. And does such art serve as a final resting place for long-held secrets or a vehicle for revealing them? These are some of the questions central to a new novel by Texas writer Stephen Harrigan, whose latest book, Remember Ben Clayton, tells the story of some of the people affected by the death of the book's title character on the battlefield in World War I, France. Stephen Harrigan is in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
I love the story about the idea you had for this book, which is a piece you were writing, 30 years ago for Texas Monthly?
That's right. Yeah, I was a staff writer for Texas Monthly, and one of the pieces I did back then was an article about Pompeo Capini. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever seen a statue in Texas, chances are it's by Capini. He did, here in Dallas, he did all the statues at the Hall of State, and he did the Littlefield Fountain at UT and the Alamo Cenotaph and San Antonio. And there was a moment in his career where he got a telegram from this old bereaved rancher in Menard County whose son had died in a fall from a horse. And Capini describes going to this ranch, this very modest ranch house, and spending the night in the son's room. And it was just, it was one of those moments where you read this and think, you know, maybe there's a novel here. Mm-hmm. And turns out 30 years later there was. And actually there's a real statue there too. It's different than the one I describe in the book. But in Ballinger, Texas, the Charles Noyes statue, you know, stands on the courthouse square, and that's the monument that Capini made for Gus Noyes, the guy's father.
Hmm. So Ben Clayton is the title character of this book, and yet we meet him almost entirely as a sort of ghost.
Right.
And it's really about, the book is about how people are trying to interpret his life after he's died.
Right, and you know, it's the story. When I look back on it myself, and you know, the writer of the book is sort of the last person to ask what it's about in some ways. But when I look back on it myself, it's a story about fathers and children. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Lamar Clayton, who is Ben Clayton's father, and Ben is, as you say, the one who was killed in the First World War. And then there's the sculptor Francis Gilheeny, known as Gil, and his daughter Maureen. And so the book sort of tracks these two relationships, even though one is a relationship with a posthumous child and the other is a relationship with a more difficult, thorny relation, father-daughter relationship. But it tracks them through the creation of this statue and the discovery of who Ben Clayton was and how he died.
There's a really poignant moment in the book where I think it's just when they're looking at the maquette of what will become the finished sculpture, and Lamar Clayton is almost without words because he feels as if Gil has understood his son better than he ever did.
Yeah, and he kind of kind of goes temporarily insane. Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know how that came about. I just needed something to happen in that part of the book, and it struck me that if you had, you know, if your son had died and you were commissioning someone to, in a sense, recreate him, then that person would have an investment in how that image came off. And, mm-hmm. and you know, you don't – sculptors are not sculptors by accident. They're, you know, particularly monumental sculptors tend to be big people in, mm-hmm. in terms of their, you know, their image of themselves or their egos of them, their egos. I mean, not
you'd have to be to create something so permanent.
I think so, yeah. And there are not lots of really wonderful sculptors who mm-hmm. are not egotistical, but it is a, you know, it's a statement. You know, I'm going to create something that will last forever, that's larger than life, literally larger than life. And so I just imagine as the book developed, this war between the patron and the sculptor began. You know, it's fairly subtle, but it erupts into hostilities every now and then. And it's like, you know, it's normal, it's natural, but in this case, there's so much at stake because it's about this man's son. Mm-hmm. And what's at stake for Gil, the sculptor, is a kind of, you know, revivifying his career. And he's aging and he's feeling the years piling up and the lack of ever having made a truly significant mark.
Well, what's so interesting about that sort of subtle war that you describe is that, you know, we're talking in both cases about sort of the masterwork of both of these men. You know, in the case of Gill, he feels like the statue of Ben Clayton will be his masterwork. You know, you would imagine that Lamar Clayton would think of his son that way. But Gill has this daughter who's a talented sculptor in her own right that he sort of takes for granted this whole time.
Yeah, and part of that is Gill's, you know, single-minded obsession with his own career and you know, the kind of sacramental duty he feels to create art. And part of it is the time they're living in. This takes place in 1919, 1920. So there weren't that many avenues for women to become, you know, artists in their own right. There weren't that many ways to become liberated in that sense. And so, you know, Maureen, the daughter, is battling both a kind of, not a negligent father by any means, but a distracted one.
Mm-hmm.
And she is battling also, you know, these, you know, however many hundreds of years of silent oppression against women. So in some ways it's almost more her story than it is Gill's, because it's, you know, what we're tracking in the book, I think, is her development as a kind of fully formed human being.
And there's an interesting parallel between Maureen's story and Lamar Clayton's story. And Lamar, and we won't give away all the details here, but he spends a portion of his childhood living among Native Americans. And there's this question of identity, which is so fluid when we're very young and is sort of determined by forces bigger than we are. And then there's a point in everyone's life, usually it's adolescence. In Maureen's case, it's, you know, at age 32, when we choose an identity for ourselves.
Right. And you know, and it's a struggle, I think, whether it's imposed on you or whether you choose it. You know,
never easy.
It's never easy, and it's a battle. And for both these people, I think trying to discover who they are, who they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And in Lamar's case, I don't know that he can ever be who he should be, because he's already who he is.
Yeah.
You know, but in Maureen's case, Lamar is 70. In Maureen's case, it's time is running out, because she's, you know, a 32-year-old woman in 1920, unmarried, with no children, living in the shadow of her father's life. So she's very much aware that she has to make a break somehow. And also she's aware, I think, that she has to make an artistic statement of some sort. So she's proceeding in two different tracks, you know, trying to become a, you know, just a normal human being, and also trying to become an extraordinary human being by becoming an artist.
And for a while, it's almost enough for her to be her father's daughter and to be his champion. And then at some point, she realizes there's got to be more than this.
Yeah. And things come to a head at a climactic moment in the book where everything sort of falls apart for her. Everything falls apart for Gill, literally. and so that's a big defining moment where she has to decide whether to shrink back into who she was or to, you know, push the boundaries and you know, grow into who she could be.
Yeah, and there are sacrifices to be made either way.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's funny because we think a lot about changes for women after the Second World War and how much that really made us think about ourselves in a different way. But the First World War had a big impact as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge one, you know, one of those huge pivotal moments in society. I mean, it gave birth to the Roaring Twenties, you know, to the growing influence of women and voting and everything. And it, you know, I think wars in a certain way, you know, while men aren't looking, women get empowered. You know?
And we're not giving that back.
Yeah, right. And so Maureen is a little bit, you know, behind the curve, you know, in her own domestic life, but she's well aware of everything that's going on and wanting to be a part of it.
Another really interesting element here is it's easy to forget that, you know, between the First and Second World Wars, much of Europe was having to rebuild after having been ravaged, and it just really didn't ever get easy.
No, and it's a significant part of the book is about that. It's about the destruction, which is unbelievable, the destruction that the First World War created. You know, we forget.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, it's really interesting to go to France, which I did to research this book, and you go to, on one occasion I went to Normandy, you know, where thousands of people were walking, you know, solemnly, Americans walking through the grounds, through the big cemetery there. And then I went to the great World War One American cemetery in Romagna, which was on you know, from another war,
mm-hmm.
and I was the only person there.
Wow.
And, you know, the constituency for this war has died off. Nobody's parents who fought in the World War in World War One are living anymore.
My guest is author Stephen Harrigan. His new novel is called Remember Ben Clayton. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find information at dallasinstitute.org. We'll return to this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Rollins Gilland here with Jeff Weddington. I am so excited about the entire day that we're having, but of course I'm also very excited, as I've said, about being here when, you know, Chris with her guests and Think, and of course Jeff Weddington is the senior producer for the show. So what is that number before we get any further into this?
You bet. It's 888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931 is the toll-free number where you can make your contribution, or you can do it online at kera.org. Rollins, you're here all day today.
I am here all day. I'm here from 9 until 7, so I'm kind of like one of those full moons in the tropics. But I tell you, one of the things that's the highlight of my day is that the person I'm with right now, you know, you're not only the senior producer for a Think, but you also, of course, are the host for Anything You Ever Wanted to Know.
That's right.
But he's also the singer, the lead singer for the Psycho Ponies, which is a Neil Young tribute band, and I've had the good fortune of seeing you.
Hey,
so see,
for
you wear
out.
Millions of different hats. You're just like Chris. She's a mother. She's a goddess. She's a, you know, she's an on-air, you know, talent of national proportions. I mean, what can you do? And I'm sure also a wonderful wife, and probably very smart when she's shopping in a grocery store.
She's a pretty stand-up person.
I think
Chris
so.
Boyd.
And but you know, the way you can be a stand-up person is to actually call this station and say, "I love this show. I appreciate these people. I appreciate everything about what Kaori brings to our lives and also what it means in the course of our lives here in North Texas." 1-888-694-6931 or
do it online. Click and join. Do it right now at kera.org. You know what you get from KERA. That's why you're tuned in right now. That's why you listen every day. This is the fall membership campaign. It's a special day. Rollins is here all day long today.
Rollins Marathon.
But you know what? We are still waiting to hear from you. For some reason, you have not yet supported the station during this drive. And you know, it really is up to you. We don't have to sell the station to you because you already use it. So we're just asking you and reminding you of how important it is and asking you to support it.
Well, we do, but I particularly feel during this particular part of the day that this is really a chance to really show how much we appreciate the real locally produced shows here at KRA.
You bet.
I mean, this is not an easy thing to do. And you know what? When you walk into a room and it looks beautiful and easy to have decorated, that means that they did a wonderful job because nothing's distracting. And that's the way I feel about the way you put that show together and the way Chris handles herself with a guest. It's all about us out there. That means you. I'm one of you. I call 888-694-6931. 888-694-6931.
Or do it online, kera.org. It is your public radio station. This is your show. Think is produced with you in mind every single day, so please support it. 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Stephen Harrigan. His new novel is called Remember Ben Clayton. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can learn about that at dallasinstitute.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk about this, Steve. The older, several of the older characters in this book straddle a time in history when the country was essentially settled, and a time when there was huge conflict between native inhabitants of large swaths of the western United States and European settlers.
Yeah, I mean that was part of the fun of writing the book, mm-hmm. because I could sort of reach deep into the historical past of Texas on several levels.
Yeah.
You know, the main action of the book takes place in, you know, around the time of the First World War, shortly after. But a big chunk of it, or at least an important part of it, takes place during the time of the Comanche Wars. And so I did a lot of research to try to get that right and to make a reader understand what it felt like then, and also what the transition from that sort of frontier reality to a more modern reality, mm-hmm. would seem like to the character. So you have, you know, people coming here from, you know, people from New York. You have people from, you know, from the Texas Plains meeting up and not quite understanding each other.
Yeah, and we should say that Gil and Maureen are living in San Antonio, but they are both from New York.
That's right. Yeah, Gil is a ferociously ambitious sculptor who has never quite reached the pinnacle of acclaim that he thinks he deserved. And so for complicated reasons, he's ended up in San Antonio, which, you know, makes him restless and nervous, because it's not the cultural capital of the world at that point. Maybe it is now. And so he's got a lot to prove to himself and to the world, and he feels a little bit like he's in exile. And he's homesick. I mean, Maureen in particular is homesick, and Gil's wife, who has moved, you know, with them to San Antonio, has died there. So there's a lot going on below the surface with him.
What was your sense of Gil? Is he as brilliant as he thinks he is or could be?
Yes, mm-hmm. I think he is. Mm-hmm. I feel like if he weren't, then it wouldn't be as interesting a story. Oh, that would be another interesting story. But I wanted him. I mean, maybe. Let me say this. I think he achieves what he thinks he has in him by the end of the book. Mm-hmm. Now, whether he had ever achieved that before, maybe that's in his head. I don't know. But I think he has the stuff. It may be just this is the project or the commission that finally brings it out.
One thing that I thought was so fascinating about him was that he's got, you know, as you mentioned, this big ego, and he definitely feels like he's capable of these things. And yet there's a certain humility as he approaches this subject. There's no detail too small for him to learn about his subject, Ben Clayton, that he doesn't want to know it to incorporate it into what he will bring to life in this sculpture.
Right. And I think to do a good job in any art form, really, you have to know it. And he's an experienced sculptor. He knows what he needs to know. Mm-hmm. And so he's taking pictures of the horse that will be in the sculpture. He's taking, you know, he borrows Ben's clothes from his father, which is a kind of touchy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, this is the way sculptors work. They have to get it. They have to get it right. It has to, and, you know, particularly the kind of sculptor I'm writing about in this book. He's obviously not an abstract sculptor. He's a representational artist, and so the details really count.
It sounds a lot like novel writing in a way.
It is. Yeah. I mean, this book took a lot of research, and it's those little tiny things that a reader or, you know, a viewer of a statue might not notice. But, you know, just little details that make you feel like you're there. Like, I remember when I was writing this battle scene that begins the book, I was trying to – I didn't know how to present this, the the tactile reality of that experience to a reader. And I read somewhere that they that the troops were issued lemon flavored chewing gum to take the edge off their thirst, and suddenly thirst became a big issue that I could understand. This, you know, to be scared and to be, you know, cold and to be sleep deprived and to be thirsty. Once you start adding those elements into the stew, it starts to come alive for the reader, I think, about what it was really like to be there.
Yeah, you write about at one point they've run out of water, and so they're puncturing cans of tomatoes and drinking the liquid from them.
Right, yeah. And it's, and they were desperately thirsty, you know, as well as being desperately scared.
Another thing that I'm struck by here is that just as war takes sort of, you know, victims that are there almost by no fault of their own, that they're members of their country's military, but they were drafted or they're serving and they really have nothing to do with the broader battle. In Arthur, who survives the war, he's this friend of Ben Clayton's, but he's grievously wounded. We get the sense that this poor kid really just did nothing wrong and is trying to do the best he can with what's left of his life, but there's not much left for him.
He thinks there's not much left. And I was writing about him, and I don't know, he's one of those characters that just sort of came, you know, some you have to work hard at. I had to work hard at Gil, but, and Maureen too, but with Arthur, I just felt like I knew him, and I just, you know, it was just sort of heartbreaking to write about him. But I, you know, because he's an innocent kid, you know, who got in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's also, the book is also about him discovering who he is or who he should be. And so he's not static. I mean, he thinks his life is over, but it's not really.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the research that you did to get every detail right. I understand that you are part of a group that promotes sculpture in Austin, certainly, but also in the entire state. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So did you already know all the art stuff you needed to know?
Not as much as I needed to know. The group I'm with is a really fun group. It's called Capital Area Statues or CAST, and we're in Austin, and it's me and Larry Wright, who wrote The Looming Tower and won the Pulitzer Prize, and Marsha Ball and Bill Whitlow. All these, you know, seven or eight really fun people to hang around with, and we've commissioned three sculptures so far, and we're about to unveil our Willie Nelson statue in downtown Austin. So by virtue of going to foundries and watching the process and talking to sculptors, I knew quite a bit. But, you know, that's not exactly the same as the way it would have been back in 1919, 1920. So I did a lot of reading of biographies of sculptors and hung out with sculptors and, just asked them questions and that kind of thing. And it's not – I have zero ability or really understanding of the visual arts. I mean, I can't – I understand how to write a book. Just even after writing this book, it's a total mystery to me how somebody could create a likeness of someone.
Yeah.
You know, that just seems magic. And, you know, of course, to a sculptor, it's, you know, it's day-to-day work. Mm-hmm. And then there are all sorts of, you know, technical tools they can also draw on. But at the heart of it, I think, is mystery. And that's what drove me. When I was writing this book, was how, you know, Gil brings something to this statue that nobody else could have brought, and what is that?
Mm-hmm.
What is that thing that you can't really see but you can feel in a work of three-dimensional art?
Well, I was interested, you know, before he begins to apply the clay and sculpt the clay, he's got to build a framework. And that was so interesting to me because I thought about the fact that at that point, before you've begun to work with the clay itself, you put this skeleton up. And at that point, it could be a million different things even with that same skeleton. And it's only in the refinement at the end that you get what it becomes.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, it's interesting because – again, it's like writing a book or something like that. It's, you know, a novel like this, has a skeleton, has an armature, mm-hmm. just like a sculpture does. And if that armature is not right, you know, it's all over. Yeah. I mean, you can all the beautiful language is for naught, mm-hmm. and all the refinements are useless if there is not structural integrity. And so I don't think of those two things as being separate, really. And I'm not sure we'd have to ask Gil. Of course, I would have to ask him through
through myself, the medium that is you. Medium, yeah.
But I think it's, you know, there is something that is brought to this statue, like I said, that you can't really describe or can't really see. But that may be in the armature as much mm-hmm. as in the final sort of refinements of the clay.
We haven't talked about this, but it's important. The statue that we're dealing with in this book is not planned for the town square. It's not planned for in front of the high school. It is planned for a very remote location on Lamar Clayton's property.
That's right. It belongs, or it is, you know, Lamar decides it should be on this sort of little mesa where it was Ben's favorite place on the ranch. So it's a challenge to Gil because it's a place that no one will really ever see the statue except Lamar Clayton, and he'll never see it again. Mm-hmm. And yet he sees, by virtue of that location and the power of that location and the way that the statue could command that location, he sees it as the potential greatness in it. And of course the flip side of that is that will he ever be recognized for it? Because, you know, it's only he created it and only one guy will ever see it.
My guest is novelist Stephen Harrigan. We're talking about his newest book, Remember Ben Clayton. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find information about the appearance at dallasinstitute.org. We'll resume our talk in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, we do have a line open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Rollins Gilliland back with Jeff Whittington as we continue with the Rollins Marathon all day and also our celebration of Think. Think, the show produced here at KERA with our senior producer Jeff Whittington and, of
right
course,
here.
The inimitable Chris Boyd. What is that number to show our love and support for this station and the wonderful kind of shows that you're listening to right now?
1-888-694-6931. If you make an appointment to listen to Think every day, if it's part of your day, if you wouldn't miss the show, and I know you do, listen,
yeah,
to Rollins, because we hear from you all the time. Support the show, support the station, do it right now. Go online to kera.org. It's really easy. Just click and join. And you know what? The drive ends for you when you make your contribution. It's that easy.
Really? Honestly, this is one of the few things where we all feel so powerless these days. That's what I hear from everybody. We feel so powerless to control anything. Well, I can tell you, this is one thing we can control. If we call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and actually give some money, we control the length of the drive. And I know that sounds like a cliche out there, but I promise you, that nothing is more true. It's kind of like if you keep filling a bathtub and it overflows, that's a given. Well, that's the way it is. 888-694-6931 in order to fill up the coffers here.
And you know, Rons, we know because we talk to people who listen to the station, you and I both do, that you know, when things are uncertain, you want to turn to a trusted source for information, for news, to find out what's
mm-hmm.
going on. And on the Think Show, we cover a range of topics. We try to provide you with the tools, the information that you need to be a better, more well-informed
Absolutely.
Citizen. And you know what? And you get that from all the shows that you hear on KERA, whether it's the national programming, the international reporting. It's all designed to help you feel like, you know, we really do have more control over our world than maybe we think all the time.
Well, it's
and
like
that's
eating
what public
well
all
versus
about.
Just grabbing stuff, you know? That's the
Absolutely.
Way I feel. I mean, I'm not just grabbing stuff when I'm listening to this station. But I'll tell you, you know, being very specific about the kind of shows I'm listening to right now, which are guests, of course, that you've lined up as the senior producer and that right now Chris is actively interviewing, I can think of times all kidding aside, I can think of times when I've literally cried listening to this show. I remember one time the film, the movie had done a documentary, mm-hmm. the Israeli documentary that was all in
oh, it was animated.
Yes, it was animated. I'm sorry. I don't know. I just was so profoundly moved by him. And then, like, last week, I was so charmed by the woman who was had written the book, you know, The Chef, The Reluctant Chef.
Yeah.
Oh, so many different times. I mean, let's count the ways. But while we're counting the ways that we love this station and the number of times we've loved it and listened, I want you to walk down memory lane, but I want you to walk down it going 888-694-6931.
Yeah, don't be a reluctant public radio supporter.
No, Lord, I just hate that.
Log on to KERA.org right now. Do it right now while we're talking about it, because, you know, later on today you're going to get busy. We may not be here to remind you. You may not be listening later, and right now we're reminding you. So just take a moment
now. Yeah, we're not on during the world.
And go to KERA.org, make your contribution. It's really easy to do, Ron.
It is easy. If it was as easy to speed date as it is to pay money to this station, I'm telling you, I would be really busy. 888-694-6931. I guess I do feel like I'm speed dating when I turn on my radio in the morning. I work at home, and I'm either in the forest or I'm at home or I'm in my car, and it just seems like it's always KURA. And I didn't even realize how much until you started replaying Think at night, and I realized I'm often listening to it a second mm-hmm. time, which I really love. Again, 1-888, I hate to say this number too many times, but you know what? I can't say it too many times, because this is all about us having fun but also raising the money. And we do that by calling 888-694-6931.
It's a toll-free call. A friendly person you talk to will help you get through the easy membership process. You're just going to give them your name, your address, your information, credit card you'd like to use, whether you'd like to do a sustaining membership and have a portion of your annual contribution comes out of your account every month. It's really easy to do.
Very secure.
Or you can set all that up yourself if you want to fill out the membership form yourself. Do it online at KERA.org.
Which is easy.
Yeah, it's really easy.
The last time I did that, it was easy. I couldn't believe it. It's easy. 888-694-6931. I really appreciate all of you listening, but I can tell you right now, you're not listening because I'm here. You're not listening because Jeff's here. You're listening because you know that Chris Boyd is delivering the goods again with still another really amazing talent on the air. 888-694-6931 or online to KERA.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Stephen Harrigan. His new novel is called Remember Ben Clayton. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. If you'd like to join us, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We've talked about one of the themes of the book being sort of identity. Another one that strikes me is secrets and mm-hmm. whether it's merciful to keep them or cruel, or one can start out one way and turn into something else.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of secrets in this book. And, you know, again, I didn't start it that way. I didn't think, oh, this is a book about secrets. But it just, as I was writing, it just became apparent that that was really one of the major sort of drivers of this book, is the things that people are keeping from each other. And you know, at least half the time of keeping the thing secret for perfectly acceptable mm-hmm. reasons. But like you say, you know, a benevolent secret just by virtue of being hidden can kind of turn pernicious. And so a lot of this book is about those secrets being revealed, you know, reluctantly and, you know, to the people who are holding them.
And at the end of the day, or at the end of a lifetime, it really is the difference between telling a secret that works or doesn't work is wisdom. You know, you have to sort of know when to keep quiet and when to open up.
That's right. Yeah. And it's an interesting question whether you should reveal a secret. I mean, mm-hmm. is the wisdom of the situation to keep it hidden? And I think in Gil's case in this, it certainly was until it became not true, till became not wise. And you can't, I guess the point, or one of the points of the book is you can't control that. You know, you can't control a secret. It gets out inevitably, or maybe not inevitably, but usually.
Do you imagine what happens to your characters after the novel closes, or are you finished with them at that point?
I'm pretty done at that point. I I've never written a sequel, but unless something struck me that these characters need to go on in another book, I would never think about what happens to them beyond that. It just feels, you know, it's the story to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the characters are very alive to me, as they must be, I think, to any writer. And if they're not alive to you, you're doing something wrong. But it's finally, you know, it's a finally about these characters in this moment in time, whether it's a moment of, you know, 10 years duration or 24 hours. And you sort of set your clock, you know, it's like how you can, I don't know, at least I can. I don't need to set my alarm clock, really. If I go to bed and think I've got to get up at 6:30,
you just do it.
I can
do it. Natural.
Yeah, and that's kind of how you write a book. There's an internal timer that says somehow this is the end of the book.
I know that you have kids, and as a parent myself, you know, you labor over the perfect name in the months leading up to their birth. I wonder how that process works for you as a novelist as you name your characters.
Oh, it's very, very crucial, I think, and very deliberate. And if you name a character the wrong thing, just like naming one of your kids,
you regret it forever.
Yeah, right. You'll hear about it from your kids. But it's part of the creation of that character. It's a crucial part. I'm going through this new novel I'm working on now. There is a character, very important character, and it's been months and months and months, and I can't find the right name. And I think I'll know it when I discover it. But, you know, it's your introduction to that character in many ways, you know. And so I've had one book where I wasn't really sure about that character's last name, and it still kind of haunts me.
Do you go through, I mean, obviously you want to name them correctly for the time period in which, you know, you don't have any
right.
Ashleys in this book or whatever,
right.
But, you know, how much, is that part of your research? Do you look at popular names?
Oh, yes, very much. For instance, in this book, well, there were Comanche and Kiowa names in this book, and you know, I looked for, you know, in the case of Comanches, I looked through Comanche dictionaries to look for something that would grab me and that would seem right. In the case of Kiowas, I looked through, reservation rolls and stuff like that. And you know, the characters in this book, Gill's family is all Irish, so I needed Irish names. And I changed his last name 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't change it too much because I wanted his first name to be Gill.
Yeah.
So, but his real first name is Francis, which is a very Irish name. And so, the same with Lamar Clayton. I mean, I wanted a kind of...
That's a Texas name.
A Texas name, you know, and I wanted you to feel that kind of Scotch-Irish or mountain people kind of...
Moving west
feel,
at some point.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted that to be kind of encoded in the name. And so, you know, it was all, like I say, very deliberate and strategic to the degree that the strategy succeeded.
You have a character who initially seems somewhat minor and comes to play a really important role in the story, and her name is George's Mary.
Yeah, I stole that name from my wife's family.
Did you really?
Yeah, and it was my wife's great-grandmother, I think, and I just always was fascinated by this woman named George's Mary. And so I got permission from my wife's side of the family to use that name because it too sort of evokes frontier Texas for me and the tone of it and the strangeness of it really appealed to me.
Is it okay? Will we spoil something if we explain why the character has that name?
I don't think so. She was raised in a homestead where there were two Marys with, you know, two brothers, I think. I can't remember now exactly.
Yeah,
but two brothers were living.
Daughters named Mary.
Both had daughters named Mary, so it was George's Mary and somebody else's Mary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. You hear that and you get a sense for exactly how that would play out. And then the idea that a woman could be, you know, 50 years old and still called by this childhood
name.
Yeah,
right.
So is your next work something about Abraham Lincoln?
It is. I'm working on a novel, and as if the world needed another book about Abraham Lincoln. But
the world certainly wants another book.
Well, there seems to be an interest. And I'm working on a novel about an early part of his life that really fascinates me. And it's very, you know, it's only a period of a couple of years, but it's I'm sort of digging deep into that part of his life and seeing what I can come up with.
You have in this book, I felt very immersed in the time, like I could see what was happening as you're walking down the street, and you could imagine, and people eat a lot of ice cream in this, and I'm guessing that's something that, you know, was very popular in this time. What does it take to feel like you know, so that you can sort of grab for a detail mm-hmm. about what they might be reading or doing or smoking or eating? How much time does that take you?
Well, it takes as much time as it takes to find it, and sometimes you can find those things readily. Mm-hmm. But
so you do them as you go along as opposed to...
Yeah, what I try to do is understand the time in a kind of generic sense, mm-hmm. you know, and then I start doing some archival research. In this case, there were books, memoirs, biographies that helped a lot. But in terms of the actual, you know, just feel of the time, this was 1919, 1920, there was nothing better than newspapers. And nothing better than newspaper ads, you know. And
they're so fun to read, too.
They're fascinating. And you realize, you know, beech nut chewing gum, Hydrox cookies, all this stuff unfortunately, we no longer have Hydrox cookies.
But I grew up with those.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were around in 1919.
Yeah, and they were there. And all these things are very familiar. And you look at movie times and you look at what's playing at the local movie theater, and then like there's a scene where they go to a movie in the book, and I had to go back and do a lot of research, not tremendous amount, but what was it like to go to a movie during that period? And so I had books about the clothing of the time, mm-hmm. I had newspaper ads about what they were selling in the men's department of Joskies in San Antonio. So those things were very important, and I think they give the reader a sense of that this is a real – people were really living in this time, and it doesn't feel distant. And it's not – it's not – once you get into this – I also wrote a novel set in 1836 mm-hmm. about the Alamo. And once you get into this, it doesn't feel distant to you at all. It feels like, oh, this is – these are the same people we are. They just have different surroundings.
It is fun when they end up in a building or going to a place that still exists. I don't know is it the Driscoll or the Menger where I think it's the Menger.
The Menger, yeah.
Where Gil goes to have drinks, and I think it's still there.
Yeah, and by the way, somebody pointed out to me the other night that I have one small mistake in this book about people having a drink before Prohibition started, but of course those, and I should have notice this more carefully. Prohibition started in Texas earlier.
Oh.
So I might need to correct that in another edition.
Is that the kind of thing that'll make you crazy until you do?
It will make you crazy, and it will haunt your dreams the rest of your life. just the idea that there's one little tiny thing wrong just is intolerable.
Kind of like a sculptor
exactly.
making something permanent.
Right.
Do you have in your mind completely what that sculpture looks like? I mean, can you picture it as if you've actually seen it?
Kind of, yeah. I feel like I've sort of made it myself, and without ever touching it. But mm-hmm. I can close my eyes and see that statue. Yes.
My guest this hour has been novelist Stephen Harrigan. His newest book is called Remember Ben Clayton. He'll be speaking tonight to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Steve, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you, Chris.
Here.
It's been fun for me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think at KERA.org.
I'm Rollins Gilliland, back with more of the Rollins Marathon, here with my great good friend and guest, the Jeff Whittington, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know and the senior producer of Think, the show you're listening to right now and thanking God is on every day from Monday through Thursday.
That's right. Noon to 2, again at 9 to 11 in the evening. You can support the show that you listen to every day. Do it online at KERA.org. You might choose to get a copy of our guest's book. It's available at the $120 membership level.
$10 a month.
You can spread that out as a sustaining member. It's $10 a month. You can check it out online. You can check out all the other thank you gifts that are available. Lots of great ways to thank yourself when you support your favorite radio station. Or you can call 888-694-6931. And talk to the friendly voice you talk to, the friendly person you're going to talk to will walk you through the membership process. And will give you all the options, especially when it comes to thank you.
They
gifts.
Will. Yeah. I mean, it's just it's really almost like when you're on an airplane and they give you that book of all those things you can buy online. That's the way it is when you call these wonderful people at 888-694-6931. But let me tell you. The best gift you can get by calling 888-694-6931 is to support the only locally produced, and I might add, nationally recognized show, Think, here with Chris Boyd and our senior producer. And, of course, along with him, he also, of course, is the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Friday. So those are our two locally produced radio shows, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we're thrilled that the station's able to bring those to you. You're thrilled that the station's able to bring those to
Euphoric.
You.
Euphoric. That's what they are.
You listen to this show every day. Why not support it? You know, you can make your contribution right now on the phone at 888-694-6931. If you've been considering joining at one of the higher levels, perhaps you'd consider a friends level membership.
That's $1,500, and you know you get a lot. You talk about getting bang for your buck. That $1,500 ends up getting you invited to things you would not believe. I mean, it's I can't even believe the number of things. And of course, that's also going to be. I mean, I could go on and on about all the things that are going to be happening.
Sure.
You know, with a 50-year celebration, but it's just pretty much remarkable. And a lot of people I know, and you would be surprised, of all ages, really have become friends level members at $1,500. Listen, Jeff, I wanted to ask you something. Look, I'm one of the people, like, I'm listening just like you are. Everybody out there in radio land, I'm always in a car, I'm at my desk just like you are. And I'm thrilled to be here, but I'm also thrilled to be actually speaking with Jeff Whittington because, you know, he is such an important part of why this show is a success and why this station is so viable. He also happens to have the best dog in the world, Omelette, and the best wife in the world, and a bunch of other things. I mean, these people lead charmed lives, you know, when they're not here, they're just reading back issues of Red Book and, you know, telling the nanny what to do. How long were you on the air before you heard your voice and thought it didn't sound weird?
Oh, you never think your voice doesn't sound. Yeah, it's you never get.
I just
never
wonder,
there.
You know, because everybody thinks their voice is awful. I don't know if
you think
your
voice is awful.
No. I mean, I'm just asking somebody who's really in the radio.
Sure.
I mean, you know, really.
For me, it never sounds normal. But you know, it's just part of the thing. It's just there's a certain you kind of just have to get past it and.
I just wondered. I mean, it's the kind of thing I think some of us out there, you know, really wonder sometimes, you know, because any of us, when we hear a replay, we think we need to sue whoever recorded it because they've distorted our voice. You know what? I'm not going to distort the number you need to call. It is 888-694-6931. I'm going to repeat it, please. Why don't we repeat that together?
Let's do it.
888-694-6931. See, that's what coordination is here.
That's
at
right.
The station.
We worked that out. We did it. We did it live.
Absolutely.
We didn't really practice that either. I mean,
it's like you're buying the vegetables and I'm, you know, picking out a ham. Call 888-694-6931 and show your support.
Sure,
all kidding aside, for the wonderful kind of look at the kind of shows that are lined up here every day, Monday through Thursday, with Chris Boyd and Think, and they're lined up. I might add, by this guy here. He's the senior producer, and you know, and that's not easy. I mean, he is not seriously in a hot tub just receiving calls on a cell phone, you know, from people begging to be on the show.
Chris and I put our heads together, and we, you know, we're really proud to be able to plan, I think, on a consistent basis, a pretty good week's worth of shows for you who you know, you're tuned in right now, for you, Rollins, for everyone who's tuned in right now. You know, the decisions that we make here at the station across the board are all based on you. And that's why we're fine with coming to you a couple of times a year and asking you to directly support the
station. Well, I think it's three times a year you come. But you know what?
A few times.
It doesn't have to be very long if you'll call 888-694-6931 instead of saying you will. Some of you are like those people I used to date. You know, you say you're going to call and then you don't. Well, I want to know why you don't call 888-694-6931. You said you would. You've claimed you have. I know better. Call
888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org. If you're listening online, it's really easy. You're already there. Mm-hmm. Just surf over to the support page. Make your contribution. It just takes about 90 seconds.
It does take about 90 seconds. I'll tell you, sometimes when I'm listening to Chris Boyd in this show, I feel like going over and taking a bite out of that radio. It's so spiritually and intellectually nutritious. 888-694-6931. 888-694-6931 or online to kera.org. Thank you.